Hello everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association podcast entitled Trial Prep in Immigration Court, Direct and Cross-Examination. I'm Becca Miller, AILA's Education Assistant, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Rekha Sharma Crawford, who is the Vice Chair of the AILA Federal Court Litigation Section Steering Committee from Kansas City, Missouri. Joining Rekha are Andrea Sions of Brooklyn, New York, and Rebecca Sanchez-Roig of Miami, Florida. The speakers have carefully selected written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora digital library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below, a resources file. If you have any questions, please email agora@aila.org. And at this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Rekha.
Thank you, Rebecca. So thank you, Andrea and Rebecca, for joining us on this conversation about trial prepping for immigration court. I know that, Rebecca, you actually had trial this week, and so you can probably help us walk through some of this and tell us about your experience this week. Andrea, I know that you also have a lot of experience dealing with the ups and downs of immigration court and trial testimony. So let's kick it off just by kind of discussing what happens, and Rebecca, I'll let you lead here, but what happens when you have a client that comes in and you know that that case is going to be being teed up for immigration court?
So as soon as I get a case that I know is in removal proceedings, and I know I look at the facts, I review the facts, and I understand by the scope of the issue that this is a case that the government will likely fight hard, I start, sit down with my client, and I provide him or her the information that's necessary on their case, the difficulties in the case, the potential successes, where the case may be not less successful. And I interview my client in detail so that I know all of the facts relating to his or her case. And indeed, I often find that I have to interview my client several times because there will be facts and information that is important that they missed the first time we met or the second time that we met. And I don't like to be surprised at trial. And it requires sometimes a number of meetings with the client to try to get the story all put together. Once I understand the story, understand the relief that they're seeking, then I begin by getting ahead of the apparent weaknesses in the case. So if there's criminal activity, criminal convictions, or even just crimes, arrests, numerous arrests, even though they have not led to crimes, convictions, I have to begin by addressing those. I never want the prosecutor to come to court and say, oh, by the way, you know, he says, you say that the client has one crime, I've pulled up the record and there are 10 crimes or 10 arrests. I don't like to be surprised by things like that. So I try to get ahead and in front of and put out the apparent weaknesses so that everyone, the judge and the prosecutor, understands that we know what this is and where this is headed.
And Andrea, you never get clients that give you surprises like that, do you?
yeah, I would like to think so. I completely agree with what Rebecca said, and what I would add to that is that when you realize that the case is going to an individual hearing, I think we often think of the client testifying only about the subject of their relief application, but that's not actually what might happen. If that client has had any prior contacts with immigration that have created any record whatsoever, then all of that might be information that they could be asked about at trial. And so I try to think about, a lot of practitioners will do a FOIA request, which I strongly recommend, to make sure, what has that client already accrued in terms of a written record with immigration or criminal justice contact that they could be asked about at an individual hearing? And I need to have all of that so I know both what I want the client to testify about and what more beyond that scope they're actually going to be asked about, so that I can avoid those kind of surprises.
And Andrea, you're in New York, so how long is it taking right now from the first time that you meet a client to that client's case going to trial?
Right, so it depends a lot. I think this is true in a lot of cities about whether you have a non-detained or a detained case. So in New York, on the non-detained docket, you're looking at 1 to 2 years to get to the individual hearing, assuming it's not going to be rescheduled, which I understand is actually faster than some other cases, some other cities where individual hearings are being set out to 2020 and 2021. I guess relatively we have it somewhat faster in New York, where you're likely to get an individual hearing date in 2018 or 19. And so what that means is that when you file that relief application, you're going to have to review that a lot before you get, when you get closer to that individual hearing, because there may actually be changes in the client's life. They may have, you know, a different family situation, or the country conditions may have changed. And so when you get close to the individual hearing, you need to be thinking about both, do I need to update the record, and is this client ready to tell this story again, because I need to kind of start from the beginning and make sure that they know all the details we've put in the record and that everything is still up to date and accurate. On the detained docket, where we do a lot of work in my office, it's much faster. So you're going to get to an individual hearing within a couple of months. And so there's a different challenge there, and the challenge is usually getting a relief application in very quickly, making sure that it's accurate. You know, you only have a couple of visits with a client in detention before the judge wants you to file a relief application, and you need to really push and make sure that, that you're not rushing and submitting something that's not complete or that's not completely reviewed by the client and accurate, because they can and will be asked about every single detail on that application once you get to court.
And, Rebecca, what about in Florida? What's the average time right now?
It's about the same. We've got cases set out from 2018 to 2020, and I've had some judges that have found some room in their dockets and have taken a 2020 case and now made it a 2019 case. Not that it makes much difference. Apparently it does to their dockets, but it really doesn't to us. The longer the case is in immigration court, the more stale it can get in some circumstances. Or alternatively, if, for example, if you're from Venezuela and you have a good asylum claim, what tends to be happening now is actually probably going to improve your case. I want to underscore something that Andrea said. There's absolutely no substitution for not doing a FOIA. FOIAs are essential. In my prior life as an immigration prosecutor and a deputy chief counsel, I often had a lot of information that the respondents counsel didn't have, and the respondents counsel never did a FOIA, and there was information that they should have known. You have to get, again, ahead of the information, because the government is, as Andrea points out, does have the discretion to question you on many issues, including issues that seemingly don't appear to be related to the case that you have before the court. So it's important to follow up on your cases, and the longer the case is pending before the judge, the more you're going to have to review as the day gets closer to trial.
Let me ask you something. You brought up that, you know, you in your prior life you used to be a deputy chief counsel. How long? I mean, we oftentimes have the impression that, you know, some of the trial attorneys don't get the files very up until like much closer to trial. Is there a general that you can share with us that you feel comfortable sharing in terms of how quickly do the trial attorneys get those files, and how much time do they actually have to prepare?
So I can speak to Miami, it will depend on their clerk. It will also depend on the location of the file, and it depends on the individuals that are supervising the clerks. You can set a lot of rules for this, but the reality of it is if the file's at the National Record Center in Kansas, or the file is so old that it's been retired to the Federal Record Center, it takes you time to get the files. I in my experience, it could take a month just to get the file from one location to another. When the government decided that they wanted to save money, and then the shipping, the ground shipment for the trucks would stop at multiple locations, and then files sit in boxes at USCIS, for example, and it won't be until they've actually opened those boxes and charged them in that you're even going to know where the file's at. When the file's in transit, you actually don't have any idea where it's at. So I can tell you from my experience that sometimes it could take as little as 20 days to get a file if we got it overnighted and the stars aligned and it was at the record center and they could find it, or months. Trial attorneys do not, in our office, did not get their files weeks ahead of time. Some of them didn't get the file till the day before. Others might have been lucky and got the file a week before. Probably the most time that a trial attorney might have had to have gotten a file early on was 2 weeks. It's just the files come from different locations, and they're lucky at times if they get a file at all. So they don't have much time to prepare.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Andrea, what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm so sorry. No, I was just going to say, in terms of the scope of things that could come up at an individual hearing, that we've recently had several cases where a client had a relative, a brother or sister or aunt or uncle who had a prior fear-based claim that was related, that was similar, and DHS asked us to have the client sign a waiver or get that person's A number so that they could pull that relative's asylum application. And so that, I think, probably has happened to other people, but it hadn't happened to us quite this much before, and that really put us on notice that if your client has family members with a similar story, that DHS could be looking at their files as well, and all of that could come up at the individual hearing.
Well, they have always done that. And indeed, most people haven't realized that that's been standard operating procedure. If we had clients, for example, in an asylum case where there were different individuals with similar story, one was granted, one was not, I mean, it was we were required to locate those files and review those stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it comes as a surprise at times, but we did, and indeed we also did that when we had cases where you had an individual that had been married to someone else, both divorced and then married USCs, and we would locate those files to find out whether there was any fraud involved in it. Sometimes we indeed found fraud. They were still living in the same house even though they were married to other individuals. So you're always trying to find that connection to see if there was something that you could use to impeach them or jeopardize their case.
And certainly, of course, if somebody does a FOIA and has access to some of that information, it can also be used conversely, right, to corroborate an individual story to show the consistencies in the application. Have either one of you ever used it in that manner?
Yes, actually, I was just thinking about that because kind of what you just said. Conversely, we have we recently had a client whose relative had already won a very similar claim based on the same sort of nucleus of facts, and that had produced a written IJ decision, and we were able to get that, and we were able to submit that to say that, this has sort of already been tested and it's a good claim.
Exactly. And if in as a trial attorney, we would look at that and say, oh, it's the same claim, it's a very viable claim. If you would review the file and it was viable, and you'd start out by letting the judge know that it was, and indeed that could actually expedite the hearing for you.
Now, how would you guys go about, now the government, of course, has access and they can ask your client to waive, their privilege and their confidentiality issues. But if it's a family member, how do you both handle the privacy concerns for the family members? You ask them to do a waiver.
That's a difficult question. I know that how we've handled that in the past is that if we don't represent the family member, then that's their decision. And certainly if we're in touch with the family member, we've advised them to get their own counsel's advice before they decide to do that. Obviously, I think we have a little bit of a conflict there. So so we've often passed that along, but said if you want to ask somebody before you make that decision, please do.
That's exactly what we do. I don't ever engage in directing an unrepresented client to waive or not waive. I tell them it's in their best interest to contact an attorney, and we work it out that way.
And would either one of you enter as an exhibit anything from the other case as a way of cooperation? As opposed to just pure testimony or you know, take judicial notice of, would you ever take any of the evidence? Let's say that you are able to successfully obtain a copy of the file. Would that go into any of your exhibits?
So it depends on what the document is. If we have country condition reports, of course, that's not an issue. But if we're dealing with documents that relate to sworn statements that may have very sensitive information on them, I would want them to waive, to authorize the use of that. I won't use anything unless it's cleared. And in many respects, if you can certainly put the individual on the stand, they can testify. The judges will ask them, you know, several questions. You don't necessarily have to go into the weeds of their particular case at all times. In fact, I've actually seen judges where the asylum was granted by one judge, and the case of family members is before another judge. I've actually seen them go and locate the file from the previous family member and review that, and then just ask a series of shorter questions and avoid having to go in through a very long and detailed explanation of the witness, because they've got the judge's decision, the prior judge's decision. They know what's on there, and so that tends to expedite it, but I don't use any documentation that hasn't been cleared.
Yeah, I think that may probably also be somewhat of a double-edged sword, right? Because you don't want any of the inconsistencies from a prior case to bleed over either. I think there is a requirement that you spend the time to really know what it is that you're bringing over from a different case, because you may be bringing in the good, but you may also be bringing in the bad.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Let's talk about for a second in terms of when do you set the theme and the story of your case? When do you begin to start to kind of flesh that out? Let's start with Andrea. When do you start to do that?
Sure. Well, some of it in the big picture might seem easy in terms of, is this a fear-based claim? Is this a discretionary-based claim? But then within that, it's going to depend a lot on your client's life and the facts and also the actual documents that you're going to be able to get to prove that up, right? So I think the way I think about it is both in terms of what information I'm going to put in the application and in the declaration that I do, and then actually when I start getting a sense a little bit further down the line of what we're actually going to be able to prove. Right? Your client might tell you that their family is having a lot of financial hardship or medical hardship, but if you aren't able to document those things thoroughly, they're not going to be good pillars of the story. And so once I start getting a little closer to the call-up submission and I decide I'm going to do a letter brief, I'm going to do a full brief, I think that's the point at which I sort of start to frame the story. Is this a story of a person who made the single biggest mistake of their life and now they're back on track? Or this is a person who's lost his way, but his family has really like been the key that's gotten him on the right path. This is a person who's seeking protection. And this is a very easy case, Judge. You don't really have to, you know, we don't have to spend hours on this. It's so straightforward. It's within the four corners of existing asylum law. Or this is a case that I know it sounds complicated, but this is a person who's really relying on you, the judge, to kind of be the hero and protect this person from a really serious fate. So those are sort of small variations on the theme of whether this is usually a fear-based claim or a discretionary claim based on what is my submission going to look like. Because so much, I feel like, of trial prep has to do with what you've already put in the record.
Right. And along with that, I always take into consideration the judge. We have judges in Miami that don't like long, detailed explanations. So when I have that kind of situation, I try to think in bullet points and try to make big, you know, put in big ticket items into bullet points that they're going to be able to digest much more quickly and readily. I create a roadmap for my judge. I think about the story, I tell the story, but how I tell it often depends on the judge. We would have, I worked with a judge for quite a while that didn't have, he was a very smart judge, but didn't have a lot of ability to always concentrate. So you knew that you had to get your points out in a sort of one-liners, as though you were not a comedian, but you were doing one-liners. And you'd get those points out, and then that would attract the judge's attention and lead them there. I had, on the other hand, other judges where you had to completely tell a story, you know, starting with once upon a time, because that's how they heard things and they didn't have the ability to digest it in shorter sentences. So how you tell your story, when you develop your story, how you develop your story, and how you tell it is going to be very specific to the judge and the case that you have.
See, now I mm-hmm. think, and I do it a little bit differently in the sense that I start kind of looking for who is the hero of my story, who is the villain of my story, and who is mm-hmm. the victim of my story pretty early on. In fact, in our first meeting with the clients, I'm still kind of fact-finding, I am putting those pieces into place and casting those roles really early on. And I do it that way for a variety of reasons, but the primary reason is that, you know, if it is a story of redemption, then I know that we're going to need a lot of evidence of redemption. If it's a story of hardship, or if it's a story of, you know, they are truly circumstances as the villain, because, you know, we all know that these roles don't always have to be individuals. It can be circumstances. And so I use it as a way to kind of put brackets around the case to say, okay, if this is where it's going to go, then, you know, this is where we're going to need to kind of get the evidence to be the most developed. So I think I handle it a little bit differently than what I'm hearing both of you. So it's interesting to hear what different people do, though.
But I really – go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. At the end of the day, I think we're all developing a theme for our case. And that's very critical. You're actually developing your case. I litigated a lot of cases where the respondent's counsel had never even met the client. They met him in the courtroom, and where I knew it was going to be a very painful direct examination, because we were starting out from what is your name and where did you come from and do you have family members? And we would never – there was so much identifying information and foundation setting that had to be done that we could – it was very long and tedious to get to the point. And that's – that disadvantages your client right away. If you don't know the story, if you don't know the client, if you don't know – if you don't have a theme, if you've never developed it, if you think you can just wing it, it's going to be a very bad day for you in immigration court.
Right. What I was going to say is I love the way that you're framing that in terms of, you know, who's the hero of the story, because I think that I haven't thought about it in that way, and I'm going to use that, and I think that's even applicable in cases where it's not a fear-based or a discretionary claim, it's a legal issue. You may be having a removability hearing, right, on alienage or suppression, but you can still make that into a story for the judge about how actually the judge is the hero of the story, because they're going to right a wrong. So I think that's great to think about what is kind of the overarching story that I'm telling.
Yeah, and that's kind of why we do it that way, because we start our story at the bond phase, because sometimes, you know, if there's a bond hearing, you're going to need to kind of get the court listening even then to kind of say, okay, here's kind of where we're going to go. Now, clearly they're not going to remember that 3 years down the road when the bond hearing wasn't even on the record, but it does kind of start to kind of put your own case in some kind of a structure for yourself. So it's mostly done for that. But it's a good point that you bring up, Rebecca, about people who meet their, you know, who meet their clients like the day before or at court or whatever, because I was in fact just reading a BIA appeal where the testimony of the client, it was a cancellation of removal case, and the question was presence and evidence of presence. it was clear that the client had some difficulty remembering dates, but it was also clear from reading that decision that there had been no trial prep done, because when the client continues to say, I don't know how many times I left, I don't know when I left, I don't know this, I don't know that, boy, that's not only is that a problem from just your case, I think it's also a problem from a credibility issue for your clients, because now you don't know what he knows and what he doesn't know.
Well, yeah, it's absolutely true, and I have an egregious example of that many years ago during the 1997 when we had the change in the law. We had a lot of suspensions of deportations and a lot of cases in South Florida and Miami. And I'm the trial attorney on a particular case. At that point, I was already a deputy, but I had to cover a case that I had started. And I go into court, and I see respondents' counsel calling out for someone, where's my client, where's my client? In comes a client, swears them in, sits them on the witness stand, did not ask the individual his name. The individual is looking for his attorney, and he was looking for his client. It was obvious neither had met the other. And we start the hearing, and I see the respondent asking him questions, and what is your name, where are you from? And the respondent is answering, and I look at both respondent and attorney, his counsel, and there's a look of like, oh, wow, there's something wrong here. There's this puzzled look. And 5 or 6 minutes into the testimony, the judge stops the hearing and he says, sir, is there something wrong? And he says, I don't know who this man is. I don't know what he's asking me. And then the judge looks at the attorney and he says, oh, judge, that's not my client. That's not my client's name. We had an individual that he picked out of the crowd downtown Miami and waiting for his attorney, who wasn't the client. And that happened because neither of them had met their respective parts. In other words, yeah, the respondent had not met his attorney ever, and the attorney had never met his client. And so it was shocking that that was even possible, but indeed it was.
Yeah,
that is amazing. That is a very riveting story, and just I can't even imagine that drama that was playing out in that courtroom. I call it a drama. It was more like a tragedy, it sounds like. But it does bring home a point of keeping, you know, of doing your trial prep and getting your witnesses ready for testimony. So I want to talk and shift a little bit to talking about how you get your clients ready for direct examination and actually taking the witness stand. And obviously, in this instance, the attorney had never met the individual, so there was no way for him to get him ready for testimony. But how do you both start getting your clients ready for direct examination?
Sure. So I'm interested because I think probably people do a lot of different things. So what we'll do will often, again, depend on whether we have a detained client or a non-detained client in terms of how many times you can prep with them. But ideally, we will meet with a client 3 times, and then it kind of goes lower if they're doing amazing or higher if we need more help. And so what I like to do is I like to try to start and do a full direct with the client initially that's very stop and go or very slow. You can give them a lot of orientation. The vast, vast majority of our clients have never been in court before. They've never testified under oath. They're not used to using an interpreter. So I'll do a little chat with them about who's going to sit where, this is how it's going to go. The judge could interrupt. The trial attorney could interrupt. I'm going to go over this with you. Just know if something crazy goes down, I'm going to be there, I'm going to object, wait, give me a second to object. All that kind of advisals that you want to give your client to make sure that they know if things are not going well or they don't understand the question and what they should do. So I'll do that kind of orientation with the client, and then we'll practice some direct, and then I like to run that several times on several different days if I have the time to do so, and then we'll chat with the client and say, like, you know, how do you think that felt? What was hard about that? And I'll tweak my line of questioning depending on how, you know, some clients go on very long tangents and you have to adjust your questions, or some clients don't spill their guts and start crying and you have to figure out how are you going to show the way that this case is tearing apart their family without that happening. And then I will often also do a short mock cross as well, but we can get to that later. So when I get a chance, I will do three full preps with a client, but it kind of all depends on who the client is and what they need.
Right. I do basically the same thing. We do at least three mock direct examinations with them. And there's the first one, we discuss with the clients, you know, what the courtroom is like if they haven't been there before, the judge, and all the legal protocol. A lot of it it's important to note the educational level of your client is going to come into play and how questions are asked and how they may understand questions. Also, we have, for example, in South Florida, we have a lot of native Spanish speakers and we have a lot of Spanish speakers. And they come from different countries. And the translators, you may have, for example, an individual, let's say, on the stand that doesn't have as much education, can maybe come from a Central American country where they did not get much of an education and not necessarily understand how the question is asked. So I spend a lot of time with them if I know that there's going to be difficulties understanding the question, trying to impress upon them if they don't understand the question, they need to say so. I explain to them that if the question that they should answer only the question that I'm asking and not go on and elaborate, that if it's necessary, the next question will fill in the blanks, but that they should not add any information to the question that they're being asked. It's for example, in the Hispanic community, which I'm a part of, it's very common for individuals to be asked a question and then elaborate seven sentences more. And that is something that I've had to teach many of my clients to scale back and then just answer the question that's being asked. And it's important for the client to understand where you're going with your questions. If they don't understand where you're going, what it is that you have to show, and that you have to be able to prove it, then they feel less empowered when they're sitting on the stand, and particularly those individuals that have never had any experience with being in court. So I always try to explain to them in as best as I can that we have certain obligations, and our obligations are to prove up A, B, C, or D, and try to establish for them what we're going to prove, how we're going to do it, and how their testimony is going to be important to explaining our legal theory and the facts, putting it together so that the judge can see and understand it logically and credibly.
And I think we do, in our office, we do it the same way. We do three preps, but a little bit different in the sense that we do on the first prep that we do for testimony is just about the preliminaries. It's about setting up, like you were saying, Rebecca, setting up, you know, who's the attorney, who's the government's attorney, how do you refer to the judge. Some of my African clients will refer to the judge as my lord, and we say, okay, that's not how not the way to do it here. So we go through some of those cultural issues in terms of, you know, and the weirdness of, you know, this isn't TV, so, you know, so many people will expect the courtroom trial to be just as riveting and non-mundane as a TV show, and we'll say, look, there's not any video, there's not going to be any fingerprints, there's not going to be any of this stuff, but, you know, this is how we have to go through it. And then we'll go through it to say, okay, you know, you are not trapped on the witness stand. If you need to use the restroom, you can say, I need to use the restroom. If you need a glass of water, you can say these things. And try and just, we spend a lot of time on that first one, just kind of laying out the foundation. And then what I ask them to do is I ask them to go home, go through all of that, and then at the second time that they come in, when they come in, their homework assignment is to go over their application just for dates and things like that. So I tell them, I said, I'm going to give you some homework, and you're going to go over your application to make sure that you know it. And then when you come back, we're going to do testimony, and we're going to pretend like it's your day in court. And so I oftentimes will have people sit in and play roles. And you know, even if it's just to kind of give them that familiarity. And I think some of that started for us because long ago in a lifetime far away, the Kansas City Immigration Court used to literally be in this little tiny room that reminded me more of the principal's office in an actual courtroom. Mm-hmm. And so people didn't take it seriously because they didn't have all of the trappings of a courtroom. And so we started doing that, and we've stuck to it because it's kind of been a very effective way to do it. But we started doing it way back when we said, look, you have to take this seriously because we get one shot at the apple. And I understand it looks like the principal's office, but it really is a court of law. So that's kind of how we do it. And I also tell them, I said, look, I'm not trying to be mean to you or rude to you, but my game and my role here is to be meaner to you than the DHS counsel. I want you to walk out of that hearing and go, boy, you were meaner than that counsel ever was. So I think that's how we do it. Do you write out your questions? Do you write out your direct examination questions?
So I still do. It may be a relic of an earlier part in my career, but I do normally still write out my direct questions, or at the very least I will write, you know, all of the elements that I need to get out, and it helps me, at least at this point, to think about the order in which I need to present things. Kind of like, you know, Rebecca was making a really good point. If you're not prepared, you can start at the beginning of the client's life when you don't actually need to. And so it helps me to sort of at least write out the order in which we're going to go through the claim. So I typically do still write out my direct, or at least sort of the bullet points of the details that I need to elicit so that I could kind of mark them off with my pen, what we have and haven't gotten to. And I actually, that relates to something I was going to say, that I really like what you said about kind of what the client's homework is, and making sure that they have their application and their declaration. And I've had clients, because they can see that I've written out some questions when we prep, I've had clients ask me if they can have my questions. Who are particularly anxious. And I always say no. I never give them my questions. We're not trying to do a play here. We're not trying to coach them for exact answers. But I will say, if your homework is to know your declaration. But the questions might change depending on what happens at the hearing.
Right. What I do is I sort of brief my questions. I have all of the subject areas that I need to cover. So if I'm doing an asylum, there will be the injuries, the violence, the persecution, the firm resettlement. There'll be all of the areas that I need to cover, and underneath that, and these, every area will be a particular heading in a brief sort of format, and underneath that I'll say, doctor, police, where were you, demonstration, dates, and I'll put words that in my mind will trigger the question that I need to ask. And one thing that I still do today, and have always done, is I make a note on my pad, who, what, when, where, how, describe, and sometimes why, because I need to remember that if I'm on direct examination, I have to tell a story in a particular way. While objections aren't all, many trial attorneys don't object, there are others that routinely object. And you want to make sure that you're following the rules, despite the fact that the rules of evidence don't necessarily apply in immigration court. And I've seen a lot of testimony on direct that was really much more of a cross-examination, where we had to step in and say, you know, hold it up. This is not going to, we're not going to go this route. But I keep that, so it reminds me of how I need to ask the question. It doesn't matter in many respects how long you've practiced. The basics should never be forgotten, and that will help you. At least it helps me to get through the direct examination. And then there's a couple of things. I think one of the most important things that I try to do is that if there are issues that I can get an agreement on from the government, then we don't need to go through them. So if we can address an issue, and we can address the fact that there is no firm resettlement, okay? They've never been anywhere else, so we don't need to spend 10 minutes as you go to here and there or whatnot. If they flew from point A to point B, we can admit they've never been in another country and other than their own, and let's move on from that, because I've actually seen testimony where they go through every single one of the factors, including firm resettlement, or and when that wasn't even relevant. And irrelevant issues can just break up the flow of a case.
Do both of you start with the respondent, or have you ever not started with the respondent and started with a different witness?
Oh, no. There are times where I haven't started with the respondent.
And one of the major... Sorry.
Go ahead, Anna.
I was going to say the example that comes the clearest to my mind is in a case where we've had a forensic evaluation. There are times when we'll start with the expert because
exactly.
they will contextualize what's going to happen when the client testifies.
Exactly.
And there's really no rule as such. And I think most judges, if you give them a reason why you're starting with someone other than the respondent, I think most of them are used to you starting with the respondent, but you don't have to. And as long as you can provide some kind of a basis as to why you're going in a particular way, I've never had a judge say no.
Right. Your first witness, that's right. There is no rule. And your first witness really is going to set the tone for your case. So that needs to be a good, strong witness, such as if there's injuries and there's significant issues that an expert can quickly clear up, that's going to be a good witness to start up with.
Yeah,
no, so I
that
really
kind of goes back.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Andrea.
Oh, no, no.
I was just going to say that to me, it actually just goes and reinforces, you know, the rule of primacy and recency, right? So you want the strongest thing to go first. You don't really necessarily want to start with the weakest part of your case. And, in fact, that should go somewhere in the middle as opposed to any place else. So if you have a good witness that is going to really set the tone and really make your story come alive, then that really should be your first witness.
Right. Equally so for your last witness, because your last witness and your first witness are two witnesses that are more often remembered than some of those in the middle. And your last witness has to be convincing, equally strong, and very clear, and sort of sum up the evidence in concise manner. Your client is often not that individual.
Right. Yeah, that's actually what I was just going to say, is that especially in a discretionary application where you have a lot of family members or friends or employers who are potential witnesses, you know, often we'll put a lot of them on the witness list, and you know that they're not all going to actually testify. They're not necessary. But sometimes you have that one, you know, the mother or the wife or the family member who's just amazing on the stand. They're very articulate. They're very emotional. They really just bring home the equities in the case. And, you know, sometimes the judge will kind of try to move you along and say, oh, we don't really need to hear from this person. But if they're not willing to grant the case, I will often fight to at least put them on briefly, because they're really going to make a strong human connection, even if I say, okay, I'm just going to put them on for a very limited purpose.
That's correct.
And how do you deal with objections from DHS? Do you ever get an objection that says, you know, we want the respondent to go first, or other objections, but most primarily with, you know, if they insist that the respondent go first?
So that's a good question, very good question. I've never had DHS counsel object to my order of witnesses, but if it's my burden, it's my case. And if it's my case, I decide how I'm going to put it on. And there's no rule that says that the respondent has to go first. And once I simply state that and ask them to point to a rule that requires the respondent to be the first witness to testify, they would have to back down from that argument, because it just doesn't exist.
Don't you think it's funny when you actually ask, please cite the rule. They don't know what it is. Speaking of, did either one of you invoke the rule?
Oh, that's interesting. If they don't ask me, I don't invoke. If they don't ask us to invoke the rule, that's their problem.
And for just for so that everyone understands what I'm saying when I say invoke the rule, it's just sequester witnesses, right? So
right.
You can't have any witness that is going to be testifying in the room while another witness is testifying until they have actually finished testifying. But it's not oftentimes used, and I don't know that DHS oftentimes will use it. I think I've only seen one or two prior prosecutors, like, you know, DA prosecutors come in, and then they'll invoke the rule. But generally, if they're trial attorneys for DHS, they don't know to do that, which is which is fine.
We do that. We do get that.
It's great for us.
Yeah. Yeah, we do get that on the New York detained docket where there's an expectation that the witnesses will wait in the waiting room. And when they do that, then we just go ahead because I don't want to lose the ability to use that witness.
Right. We in Miami, the rule is invoked readily. If the trial attorney doesn't invoke it, the judge does. I mean, the judge invokes it on behalf of the trial attorney, and the witnesses all have to leave. I always tell my witnesses that they're going to be sequestered in another room. They will have to wait there because I know that that's what happens typically here. I don't know how it happens in other jurisdictions, but here it does. We were always taught to invoke the rule here, and new attorneys that was one of the first things that they were taught that they had to do, because otherwise, you know, some judges would obviously have no problem with it. They could have all the witnesses sitting there, and they'll say this is not like any trial, that's like, you know, a federal court trial. This is an inquiry. We're asking questions, but obviously you can see the potential for issues that arise from that.
And that also then goes to, you know, the order of your witnesses. Like on an adjustment case, you're going to put the wife on first because now she's not subject to the rule anymore and she can stay
right
in the room while the husband testifies, which is oftentimes a good thing for them because they get so stressed out by, you know, I don't know what's going on and I'm having to wait outside. And so that also can sometimes help you figure out which witnesses to put on first. Do you have a lot of DHS objections in your jurisdiction?
In good question. In Miami, it depends on the trial attorney. There are a handful of trial attorneys that believe it's their role to repeatedly object, and others don't object at all,
mm-hmm.
like at all. In cases where clearly an objection should have been raised.
I was going to say, in New York, I think. Our experience in the non-detained docket is that a lot of the trial attorneys don't object very much, and it's more aggressive on the detained docket, but the kind of objections is pretty specific, so that the objections that we get are mostly that the questions are leading, or sometimes that we've gotten irrelevant, or something's not, you know, within the scope of the application. So it's actually a pretty small universe of objections, so if you know those could be coming and you're ready, then they usually go okay. I mean, I think this is something, you know, Rebecca was saying that she like writes, you know, who, what, when, where on her questions as a reminder. And I think that's probably the number one objection that we get, if anything, on direct, is that we're leading the client. And I think for young attorneys, I often see who are really, really smart and diligent and just know their record back and forth. That's the number one thing that I see them get rattled by is the objection that they're leading and they haven't prepared for how to handle that. So that's one reason why I recommend for younger attorneys that if they don't feel comfortable adjusting on the fly, that they write out some different ways that are non-leading.
That's a very good point, Andrea, because I don't think that law schools do a very good job of teaching attorneys how to ask questions on direct examination. Direct examination seems easy, but it's very difficult. To get the story out without leading your witness, without actually telling your witness what it is, how it is you want them to answer, is much harder than most people realize. And leading questions is the number one objection that I would use when I was a prosecutor, and it's still the number one objection that prosecutors use today. There are many, many, many newer and younger attorneys that have absolutely no idea how to ask a question that's not a leading question, and that's going to make it for choppy waters as they go through their direct examination. So you can ask the question, but you have to figure out if you've written down your questions, okay, then you need to figure out how do I ask that question so it's not leading. And there's one way, there's a few ways, who, what, when, where. And if you remember those basic rules, then you're going to figure that out. And at that point, yes, you should be writing it down, because you're sort of doing your client a disservice if every other objection is leading, leading, leading. You're never going to get through that direct examination. And that's the critical part of your case if you're not able to put on your case.
Or you're going to get flustered and skip the subject, but then
yes.
You can't skip the subject.
Correct.
And I think a lot of times, if you have a very experienced TA, they're going to know that if it's a young attorney, they're going to object sometimes to throw you off your game. And even if, you know, normally they're asking leading questions and they're harmless leading questions, I've seen it time and again where the TA will object. I mean, just simply to throw the newer attorney off their game.
Yes.
What about cross-examination? Tell me how both of you get ready for cross-ex.
Well, you know, as you're preparing your case, you have an idea of where the weaknesses of your case are at, or at least if you don't, you should. So you know that the government is more likely than not to focus on those weak areas. For example, if you claim that you were beaten by a group of masked men, but you can't specify where, what time, or have any identifying factors such as, oh, they were just masked men. You know, you can expect questions on cross relating to the masked men and the area to impeach your credibility. So I look at the areas of my case that I think may be the weakest. And then I anticipate that that's where we're headed. After a while, and depending on the trial attorney, you get an idea of where the government is going to head with the questions. Unless it's a very, very complicated case that's been assigned to a particular attorney, maybe a national security case, a terrorism case, where there's been a lot of work done on them. Many of the cases have areas that are just rife with the ability to have very colorful cross-examination on it if the individual has particular weaknesses in that area. And so you know criminal records, for example, the type of criminal record, for example. And then you anticipate that and get ready for the questions and then know that your client's going to have to know how to respond to that question. Stick to the subject of the direct, stick to it. And not get flustered by the questions that the prosecutors are going to ask him or her.
Right. So I will always pretend cross the client as part of the prep, sometimes just the last prep, but make sure we've done it at least once. And we'll tell the client, okay, listen, the trial attorney, they could say nothing, they could be 5 minutes, or they could go an hour, and we're going to practice being mean to you now. And this is your job. So the same orientation that we gave them on direct, we'll give them a different orientation for cross and say it's really, really important that you give a very short answer. If you don't understand the question, you say, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. That you, if you're not sure, pause a second, I might jump in. Same thing. And so the gold standard is it's great to have a colleague come in and cross the client so they get the experience of a new strange person being sort of mean to them. You know, in a detained setting, we don't always have that luxury, but well, I'll still make sure to make some notes and cross the client on what I think are the biggest weaknesses of the case. And then the other thing that I'll try to do is make sure to ask some cross questions that are just strange and out of nowhere or that misrepresent what happened on direct, because I feel like that happens quite a bit, where I might say, didn't you say, you know, XYZ? And actually the client didn't say that, because it's so important to try to empower the client to say, I don't understand, or no, that's not what happened. And not every client can do it, but it's well worth making sure they know that that can happen.
And do you object during cross-examination?
Sure.
Yeah. If it's where, if it needs to be objected to, yes, indeed.
What, if you had to boil it down, what would be, just like you said, leading was the number one objection for direct, what would you say would be the number one objection for cross?
I've seen, for example, one where the lawyer is testifying, where the lawyer, rather than asking them a question, it's such a compound question that it sounds much more like testimony. So we have compound question, testimony by the lawyer, and one that has unfortunately become much too frequently used here is when we have they really batter the witnesses. There are a few trial attorneys that believe that this is the trial of their lifetime and are very rude and almost to a point of harassment, and I just step in. I step in and allege that that's not only improper. It's not only improper questioning. It's improper conduct by a government official. So you can't let certain things get away. I've seen them really batter, especially witnesses that are that tend to be much more low key or you know less educated, that have difficulties often answering questions cohesively because it's just not within their DNA. It just didn't happen. So
right.
and they believe that if they can't answer the question the way they want it to be answered, then they have to be lying, and that indeed is not true.
I agree. I don't think it would just be one objection, yeah, but maybe a kind of group of related objections for when the assistant chief counsel is being really confusing or making a very confusing record that you need to step in on. So whether that's objection that it's a compound question, that they're actually misrepresenting the record, which is, you know, not technically a federal objection, but I will not hesitate to say, like, objection, that's not, you know, didn't you say whatever? And I will say, like, that's not what happened, to break it up, and or, like, that's not what the Exhibit H is, and then ask an answer when they, you know, the client says no, and they'll, like, go on, but isn't that true? But isn't that what happened? And I'll say ask an answer.
For
me, my favorite objection of all time is lack of foundation. It is an underutilized objection that is worth its weight in gold because even in cross-ex, you know, there has to be a foundation for the question. And a lot of times when you say lack of foundation, I have found that they don't know what that means, and so they just move on to something else. And sometimes it is a very powerful objection, but it is my all-time favorite objection because I think a lot of times, you know, you think cross-ex, we get to do whatever we want. It doesn't exactly work like that. So if DHS is asking questions for which there is no foundation in the record for it and it's just conjecture, it's a really nice piece to have in your arsenal because a lot of times they don't know how to diffuse it. But you're saying, Rebecca.
You're absolutely right. I don't use that often, and that's absolutely right. One of the ones that we do have to often use is beyond the scope of direct. So you want to hold your prosecutor to the scope of direct questions. Unless there's a reason why they're going into a particular area that they just can't. So inevitably, the prosecutors believe that they can question you on everything, your client on everything, and there are rules on that, and you can't go beyond the scope of direct. Now, does that mean that the judge couldn't? No. Indeed, the judge can and does sometimes ask the questions that the prosecutor has failed to ask and or should have asked, and, you know, that opens up a whole different scenario, and at that point, you're going to have to address those issues on redirect.
Do you both do closing, or do your judges in your areas allow you to do closings?
Our judges do.
Yes, and so sometimes it's not necessary, kind of the same as with redirect. Sometimes you decide I'm going to quit while I'm ahead, but I usually do prep very loosely some bullet points that would be, you know, one page or less of a closing, and then during the hearing, I'll sort of scribble on it about, you know, things that didn't go as well or things that went particularly well, and I will ask to do a short closing.
I agree with that.
So
that's exactly how we do it.
So we have about a minute left, and I'm going to put you both on this spot, but you're both, you know, experienced trial lawyers, so you know you can deal with a surprise question. If you were going to give one best practice to sum up practicing in immigration court, what would that one best practice be? And since I started with Andrea, I'm going to start with Rebecca.
The best practice to sum up immigration court or your practice in immigration court is that in immigration court, there's no substitution for preparation because inevitably you're going to be surprised by something. The government is always going to have more material than you have. You need to try to exploit all of your avenues of investigation and garner as much information as you can and prepare. And if you are indeed surprised, then maybe it's time that you need to ask the judge for some time to address the issue if that's appropriate at that point. Other than that, it may become an issue for an appeal.
Okay. And Andrea, wrap us up.
I have a similar tip, which is something a mentor told me, which is this is not a time sport. Due process is more important, even though the court might be pressuring you on time. You have to make the record for your client. So if you get an unpleasant surprise that DHS shouldn't have sprung on you, that's not your client's fault, and you need to fight for the time to address it properly. Or even if it was something that, you know, that you should have known about, don't be afraid to ask for a 5-minute recess or a 10-minute recess to talk to your client, or if necessary, to ask to hold the record open to respond to it properly. Don't get flustered by the time and make your record for your client.
Thank you both. That has been outstanding. I really appreciate all of the information that we've shared today, and that will conclude our podcast. Thank you, everybody, for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. For those of following 4-digit attendance verification code. The 4-digit code is 7839. Again, the code is 7839. Please visit AILA's WebCLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.